Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Men's Room podcast from TalkSport is proudly sponsored by Toolstation. If, like me, you love a little deal, then you can join the Toolstation Club today online, in-store or via the app, and you will save some money getting a 5% discount shopping with Toolstation, as well as a chance to get your hands on some fantastic prizes, such as TVs, gaming consoles, and even holidays. If you keep spending, you'll keep on saving. That's the Toolstation Club. So make sure you join today, online, in-store, or via the app. A Bosch.
Another episode of the Men's Room. Adi Oladipo, Rory Jennings. You know how it goes in the Men's Room. We literally talk about absolutely anything, from the good to the bad, inspirational, emotional. There isn't a subject, Rory, that we don't touch upon.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's very worthwhile, isn't it? And I do thoroughly enjoy these conversations. I'm massively looking forward to this one now.
Yeah, this one should be a good one because we have a very, very special guest in the building. Billy Monger is with us. And I want to say just from the get-go, and look, I know you probably have been told this for many a year, but you are a true inspiration. I can be emotional watching old episodes of EastEnders, if I'm honest with you. But watching Driven last night, and I thank you to our producer for sending it through to me. I mean, that got me going immediately. From the first 20 seconds, your mum, your dad, your sister, and what you've overcome and how you've overcome it. You know, often people get labeled as inspirational for doing the smallest of things, but what you've had to deal with in the last six, seven years, I just find incredible. Honestly, I find incredible. And normally when we get a guest on, I always feel like we can relate to them in some way. Like, I mean, you know, whether someone going through mental health, depression, someone that's been in and out of jail, there's always that, yeah, I can hang on to that. What you've been through, I can't. I can't relate to it. Which is why I just find it so inspirational that you're here with us now, just talking, laughing, joking. It's incredible. For those of you probably thinking, Adi, you're blabbering on, what happened? Obviously, you had a horrific crash in Donington, what, April 2017?
Yeah, back in 2017. Yeah.
Back in 2017, you lost both your legs. Mm-hmm. And again, if you are watching this and you haven't seen Driven, it was a doc produced by BBC Three. It's on YouTube now. The fact you had that crash and 11 months later, you're racing an F3? I'm sorry. That's just ridiculous. Let's go back if we can. Let's start at the beginning and we'll get to that again. How did you get into to kart, into racing? Where did that love come from?
Do you know, it came from my dad, really. I think it's kind of the thing for a lot of like kids to get into racing. It's quite a unique sport, you know. A lot of lads get into football, a lot of my mates, that was their thing. For me, when I was 2 years old, my dad went out and brought me my first ever go-kart, and he always tells me the story about, you know, he sort of rocked up to this guy's house and said, oh yeah, I'm buying a go-kart for my son, and you're meant to be like 7-8 years old to drive this go-kart. So my dad was fairly keen to get me to have a go, and I was with him in the front, in like a baby seat in the front of the car, and the guy like sort of like pushed the cart towards the van, like to sort of put it in the back of the van so we could head off, and said, oh, who's it for? It's for Billy, my son, he's in the front of the van. The guy had a little double take at me and went, he can't drive that. It's for a 7-8 year old, and I was 2 years old. So I think I first drove it when I was six, just round a local go-kart track near Meing, sort of Croydon, and it was basically a circle with a little chicane in it. And my dad used to, I was that slow when I started, my dad used to run around the track in front of me, and he's not exactly like Mo Farah or someone like that. So, you know, he'd do a couple laps, be panting himself, and I'd just be that sat there just following along. And it just kind of spiraled from there, really.
And did you love it? Did it immediately catch you? Was
yeah.
it a passion that just resonated straight away?
I just loved doing it. And it was something, you know, my dad was really passionate about it himself, so I could, you know, it was like one of those things when you do something with your dad that you both enjoy, and that it was like, it kind of, like I say, when I started, it was like we'd do it once a month. Yeah. So we'd go like one weekend a month, we'd go on a Saturday morning down to Croydon, sort of have a go around the track, and then quite quickly that was like, oh, can we do another weekend this month? Yeah. Can we do two? And then eventually when I was sort of 7, 8 years old, every single weekend we'd be putting the cart in the back of the camper van and travelling like somewhere around sort of mainly the south of England to start off with, but eventually the whole of England just in our camper van. It was like a family holiday every weekend sort of thing.
It's amazing. Mm. Do you know what, Billy? Do you mind sort of talking us through the day that obviously that accident happened?
Yeah, sure thing.
Like what was happening? What was the occasion? What were you feeling going into that day? Because it's like mind blowing to me, this. Like, it's such a sad story, but it's such a poignant story as well that people, I think, will really want to hear and will relate to.
Oh, yeah, to be honest, it was like any other race day. There was nothing particularly special about it. You know, it's what I was used to. You know, I woke up on the Sunday morning. On the Saturday, we had the qualifying session at Donington Park, and we had the first two races of the weekend. I got a podium in the first race, in the second race, and a mechanical failure. So it was sort of a mixed weekend. But, you know, there was some promise there, the first race, getting a podium. Woke up on the Sunday and was sort of ready to make amends for the mechanical failure the day before and just get out on the racetrack and do what I knew how to do best, which was, you know, go out there and race and get stuck in. The only thing I would say in terms of the conditions that we had on that day, it was sort of like an overcast day, but as we were all sat on the grid before we go out to race, you know, the mechanics are doing their last checks, this, that and the other, it started to rain, it started to drizzle in the air, and we're all on slick tyres, and that as a driver is like the most tricky conditions you can face, because it means that, you know, the cars are really slippery, it's easy to, you know, make a mistake, go off track. But those actually conditions that I loved, because when I started at Croydon and going up to places like Tilbury as well, which were the tracks I started off with, me and my dad, sometimes when it would do that, it would rain, we were on slick tyres, all the other kids would come and put wet tyres on, my dad would just leave me out there and just go, you know, so you could get used to the finding the grip in those tricky conditions. And I think genuinely that made me such a better driver. You actually hear a lot of the F1 boys say the same sort of thing, that their dads did that for them, and it made a difference, that when you put the wet tyres on, all of a sudden you're like, oh, I've got loads of grip. And, you know, it changed the mindset of, yeah, you know, rather than being apprehensive like you were used to it.
That fear's gone, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like that fear's gone and you just feel more comfortable in those mixed conditions. So as soon as it started to do that, I was like, right, okay, this is it. Like, this is good for me, ready for this. First corner of the race, I think I was lining up sixth on the grid. The front two guys crashed into each other, so I had to spin off to avoid them too, so it was the worst start going. So again, at that point, it's just like, I've got nothing to lose now. I'm at the back of the grid. It's just like head looking forward, like rather than sort of, you know, thinking what's going on behind you as well. I had like one car behind me. I was like, right, okay, head down. Sort of coming through the traffic, overtaking people. I think literally the corner before my accident, I passed someone up the inside, so I was making good progress, and then just came up the hill at Donington Park after the old hairpin. So you kind of, obviously in a single seater in an F4 car, which is what I was in at the time, you're super low to the ground. I think that's something that sometimes it's hard to explain, that perspective. Two cars were side by side in front of me. Next thing you know, they pull out the way last minute because someone had spun off because of the conditions and was on the racing line, and I'm doing 125 mile an hour.
Oh, mate.
There's a stationary car there with no time to react. So
was somebody in the car?
Yeah. So there was someone. It was actually, in fair, it wasn't even stationary. The car, because it was on the hill, was actually slightly rolling back towards me at like a couple mile an hour. So, you know, it basically hit that car and everything all came to a halt.
We've seen impacts before. Like, I'm a big F1 fan, so you've seen impacts before. I'm a big NASCAR fan. That impact though, watching that, and obviously because there's a camera in your car, seeing that head on like that, it's one of the worst I've ever seen. Like that head on. And it's funny, when going watching the documentary, obviously because I've known of, and you're okay now and we're fine, but the first thing that came to my mind was your mum. It's weird, that's the first thing that I'm thinking about when I'm seeing that, is your mum. It's not your dad, because obviously, look, he's a racing driver. It's your mum and how she feels. And then your sister running to you as well. When you watch it back, you see me and Rory's reaction, we're both like that still.
Yeah.
When you watch it back, what's your feeling watching it back?
Do you know what? It's really weird because it was pure coincidence that that weekend I had that onboard camera on the car, because that basically gets moved around from car to car different weekends. So it was the second race of the season. Mm. Obviously, I was one of the championship contenders, so they decided to just stick that camera on my car for that weekend. So on another weekend, that angle with that footage wouldn't have been available, and you know, and it wouldn't have gone out live on TV, and people wouldn't have seen firsthand what the accident looked like. It would have probably been like a cut to from a wide angle. It would have changed the whole dynamic of how
the
that
whole perception of how bad it was. Yeah,
no one would have seen that personal perspective. So yeah, it, like I say, it all came to a halt, and yeah, my family were there quite quickly, but yeah, it was a weird.
Can you remember
weird moment.
The moment? Can yeah. you can you remember? Presumably up until you then can't remember.
Yeah, so I was awake in the car whilst it happened, and I was awake after the accident for about 45 minutes. So I was in the car while they were trying to figure out a way to get me out of the car.
Were you having conversations with the people that were trying to get you out?
Doctors.
Were you compass? You were able to voice the way you were feeling and where you were hurting and what?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. By about 40 minutes in, I'm on a lot of medication at that point. I'm seeing all sorts. Yeah. Like I'm kind of there, but not there. I'm still conscious, obviously. But yeah, at the time, the adrenaline like you've got flowing through your body whilst you're doing that sort of, you know, whilst I'm driving, it all comes to a halt. And you mentioned obviously the car that I'd hit, there was someone in it. I could hear him screaming, but I felt completely fine. There was no pain. The adrenaline was that high that I'm sort of sat there and I'm almost ready to sort of, because you know, racing drivers have big crashes.
Yeah.
I'm ready there to undo my belts, jump out. Obviously glad I didn't try to do anything like that, but you know, that's generally how I felt at the initial impact. So I tell the doctors to sort of, I'm fine, go and check him out. And I think quite quickly, you know, you can't see that much in a single seat because a lot of the cockpit covers sort of your lower body and stuff like that. But I could see my knee was sort of up, sort of close to my like face, and like my body position was a bit funny. So I kind of thought there's been some sort of frontal impact here, but I couldn't tell you how bad it was, whether I'd broken an ankle, whether I'd, you know, just like got away with it completely. Like I say, there was no pain, but it was more the doctors and the medic sort of faces quite like in the first 5-10 minutes where they're looking kind of thinking, oh gosh, like how do we go around this? They're obviously trying to put on a brave face and they're doing their job, but you know, you can kind of read people's body language, and I was like, okay, maybe this is more serious.
The severity becomes apparent when you're looking at the faces of the people dealing with it and the volume of people that are dealing with it.
How old was your sister at the time?
So I was 17 years old, so Bond would have been 16.
How well she handles it's incredible. Obviously, your dad runs to your mum, she comes over to you, and she's trying to keep you calm.
Yeah.
But she's obviously now you've explained the positions of your legs and your knee, she's obviously seeing that.
Yeah, so she's seeing
a bit.
She's
still trying to be calm with you, like, it's going to be okay, it's going to be fine. How she handled that's incredible.
Yeah, she was a rock star in that moment. Because by the time she got to me, it'd probably been, I would have said, 15 minutes after I'd been stationary in the car. So I think by the time point she came up to me, they'd cut my fireproof overalls and everything away from me. You know, they'd put like foil blankets over me, I think, for my body heat and stuff like that. And given me all this medication stuff. So they'd done a lot already by the time she'd rocked up. But yeah, my mum and my dad was looking after my mum because she was obviously in the pit lane and no one was really knowing what was going on. So at first they got told, oh yeah, we think he's broken his legs, and that was kind of the most information they kind of got, but they couldn't see me, so there was only one person allowed out on the track, so that was Bonnie. So she came out, she was basically just by my side, sort of saying, Bill is going to be all right, you're going to be okay. Because I think after about 20 minutes I started to panic, like sort of a little bit, and was starting to think like, am I not going to make it, sort of thing, like because of those reactions and stuff. And like, yeah, I think that started to creep into my mind. She was really good at just keeping me sort of as chilled as possible, being like, you're going to be fine, just keeping me chatting, preoccupying me, basically.
Yeah. 3 days later, you wake up, you're in a hospital bed, a doctor comes in to see you and obviously gives you the news that we've had to amputate both your legs.
Yeah.
Go through that if you can for us.
Yeah.
I know it's probably going to be difficult, but
that's all right. I've talked about it quite a lot. So,
go through that moment when the doctor walks in and gives you that news.
Yeah, obviously, so I I came around 3 days after my accident, but I always say like the first sort of day and a half, because I was on so much medication, like I'm in the room, but I'm not really fully aware of the situation that's going on. But obviously you have moments, even when you're not really fully aware of what things are going on, the way, you know, you can look down at the bed sheet and see, you know, where your legs would normally be under the covers, like there's nothing there. Mm. So I think subconsciously more than consciously, I kind of knew, okay, this is one, I knew it was bad already from how long it took me to be in the car and stuff like that. And then I think sort of subconsciously I'd already kind of, I was kind of aware that, you know, something bad had happened.
Yeah.
So when the doctors kind of came in, when I was more with it and kind of actually broke the news to me, it wasn't, weirdly, it wasn't like this, you know, this huge shocking moment. Don't get me wrong, it still, you know, had some force behind it. But I feel like there was part of me that had already understood that that was what had happened.
At 17?
Yeah.
How? Like, how's the mindset like that? Like, how's it? Like, how's your mind that strong at 17? Because people, you could forgive someone for just, okay, I'm going into a room, I'm shutting the door, I'm never coming out again.
Yeah.
Like, this is it now, my world's collapsed. But at 17, you're already kind of strong in the mind that this is it. This is it.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. As much as I say I was aware of the situation, that I was aware that, you know, that this had happened to me, there were still those moments. You know, I remember having some nights, particularly at night, where I had a lot of blood transfusions when I was in hospital. I think they gave me like 10 litres of blood, like I needed just to keep me going whilst they were doing all those surgeries. And there was that took my body and that didn't settle well. So I remember having a lot of sleepless nights in the first sort of week of, you know, coming out of the induced coma that I was in, and kind of basically being there sweating, my body was rejecting what was going on, and a lot of sleepless nights. So a lot of time to be with your own thoughts. Mm. So, and there were definitely moments at night which were the toughest moments for me in that whole period, where I didn't have my family sort of all around me, you know, keeping me occupied, chatting to me, this, that and the other, and the doctors there. I was sort of, you know, I wasn't even able to sleep properly. I had a nurse coming in every 2 hours at night to check me. So, you know, just as I was maybe trying to get to sleep and get, you know, comfortable, someone would come in, wake me up, you know, go through that, all that process, all the tests they needed to do. So those were the hard moments. Those were the moments where I thought, you know, started to have those thoughts, why me, you know, this, that and the other. But then during the days, my room was full of people that loved and cared about me, and that genuinely made such a big difference to keeping, they just kept me positive. And I always remember the conversation I had with the doctor who did my surgeries early on after my accident. I was super lucky that I went to a hospital called Queen's Medical Centre up in Nottingham, which I actually got airlifted down the road from there, but they didn't have a helipad on the top of the hospital. So I got airlifted about 5-10 minutes away and then put into an ambulance and then driven the rest of the way. So obviously there was a bit of faff going on that side of things, but I was out, so it didn't make a difference to me as such. But I remember speaking to the surgeon who came in, and he was a military surgeon, and he was out in Afghanistan in the height of all of that kicking off.
Yeah.
And he was telling me how he'd done 30 amputations to soldiers in a day out in the desert, in the middle of nowhere. Do you know what I mean? So I couldn't have been in better hands. I was lucky that his military duty, he wasn't on. And so he was doing his civilian duties at the time. He was serving at Queen Medical Centre when I came in. So in terms of the luck on that side of things, I couldn't have asked for a better person to take care of me and look after me in that situation. And what one thing he did for me quite early on after my accident was switched the way I thought about things. You know, like you say, you can not blame someone for being sat there going, why me? I won't be able to do this. I can't do that. Like, think of all the negatives there are. But rather than doing that, he came in and he started to tell me, listen, this is going to be a seriously hard process to get back up and walk in, to get back, you know, a normal life. But it is possible. I've seen it firsthand in the military. And if you work hard, do your physio right, do this right, you'll still be able to walk. You'll still be able to have an independent life. This, that and the other. So he just switched the way I was thinking about things, rather than thinking of what I'd lost, what I still had.
I think you've been very generous to make this a compliment to the doctor. Of course, I understand. I understand that he played his part.
Yeah.
But this is actually demonstrating a resilience in you.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't, of course.
Yeah, maybe it awakened something that was already there. But.
Yeah, the doctor certainly played his part and is clearly a hero. But this is a resilience within you, because I don't think it would make a difference what a doctor said to me in that situation. I don't think I would display the same level of commitment to recovery, a glass half full approach. I think it's amazing. I genuinely think it's amazing.
And not just the resilience to recover and to walk again, but the resilience to think you're going to get in a car and drive again. You know what I mean? So recovery is one thing, right? Recovery is one thing. But then telling the doctor, no, we're going to drive again. That's a whole different level of resilience.
That can't have been... Has it developed? Like, was it initial? Was it small, obtainable goals each stage? Like, at this stage, when you're having this conversation with the doctor, the ambition at that point is independence and mobility. Yeah. Isn't it? It's not driving.
It definitely wasn't. I woke up, had that conversation with the doctor and went, yeah, I'm going to be a racing driver again.
Yeah.
It wasn't straight to there. It was, like you say, a smaller step process. But I think definitely underneath it all, having that sporting background and having that passion and, you know, being, when I was 10 years old and I won my first British Championship in go-karts, I knew at that point that I wanted to be a Formula One world champion. Like, that was my dream, you know. So I feel like that hasn't changed. Like I always say, my accent changed me in a lot of ways, but it didn't change, like, the kid I was, the person I was, you know, that was still there. So it went from, like I say, at first it was just about, you know, being, I was 17, turned 18 in hospital. So you're at that stage in life where you want your own independence, you know, you're starting to become young adult, you know, you want to do things by yourself. So I remember little things of when I came out of hospital, our house, we live like on a bit of a farm. So it's like, you know, quite old and crooked and lots of steps up to rooms and stuff.
It's a great gap, like that. I've seen it.
Yeah.
It's proper though, isn't it?
Yeah, honestly,
I do understand what you're saying here. My wife's family live in a farmhouse. I can understand that an older farmhouse and older architecture isn't conducive to a wheelchair or anything.
So luckily, when I was up in hospital for 5 weeks, my dad would pop back on the weekends, and him and his mates basically started demolishing bits in the house. That what was my bedroom upstairs quite quickly got changed. My bedroom was downstairs when I got back home. My bathroom got converted so that I could use it. I was super lucky that basically I came back to a home where, you know, the steps up to rooms were now ramps, you know, and that allowed me to be independent myself. Because I always remember my mum, as soon as we got back, she went to go and push me in my chair. I was like, no, I'm all right. Because there was a ramp there, I didn't have to run on her, and I pushed myself up the ramp. And it was just like little things like that, that then, you know, I was able to take a bit of control back in my life from an early stage.
Yeah.
So I wasn't having to rely on people. Don't get me wrong with this. I still had to go into doctor's appointments and prosthetic fittings. Like, I wasn't 100% independent, but I could still do little things by myself.
And it's developmental, isn't it? Like, you're on a journey to independence. Like, you can see just small steps, these incremental moments that ultimately you're going to regain full independence.
Yeah, that was the goal. That was, like I say, that was one of the early goals, was I want to not have mum and dad having to look after me for the rest of my life. I didn't want to be a burden on someone else. I wanted to be a situation where, you know, I could look after myself, because I didn't want them having to, you know, that changes everyone's lives around me if I sort of admit defeat and go, can you just look after me for...
You probably know that I cover a sport, boxing, which... very dangerous sport.
Yeah.
And it's weird, speaking to the families, the dads want their kids to box, the mums hate it. Like, absolutely hate it. And every time something goes wrong in the boxing world, the dads blame themselves for it, for wanting to get their kid into boxing. Your dad must have blamed himself.
Oh, 100%.
For the accident.
100%. Yeah. He was probably the worst hit member of the family during that process. I remember I was in a coma for the first 3 or 4 days, and my mum said that basically whilst I was in that coma and whilst when they broke the news about me having to have my legs amputated, that my dad sort of burst out into tears and said, can he have my legs? Like, he was just going frantic and just talking all this rubbish and didn't want to be in the room. He didn't want to, you know, he couldn't stomach being around me because he felt the guilt of getting me into this sport, which had resulted in me being a double amputee. So again, from the stories and from, again, after that, he was definitely the worst hit. My mum really stepped up in that moment, and again, she had a conversation with the doctor who looked after me, and he said, how you react to this situation and the reaction and what the emotions that Billy sees on your faces when you go in to see him will determine how he feels about this situation. Mm. So if every time one of my friends or some family members would come and see me, my mum would almost give them a pep talk before they came in the room, like, right, smiles, positivity, like, we don't want to, you know, I don't want you going in there just crying your eyes out, because then, you know, Bill's going to think, yeah, if they're thinking it's that bad, it is that bad. So
have you explored those feelings with your dad? Have you had the conversation with your dad? Has your dad perhaps tried to apologise to you for bringing you into it? And you're like, and maybe, you, well, what do you say?
Yeah, he definitely at one stage or another has kind of said that, you know, about feeling guilty and had went through that stage of like apologize. I think he did apologize to me once for getting me into the sport, and I was like, listen, you got me into the sport, but you didn't, you know, make me do it from the age of 7 to the age of 17. Like, you didn't force me to do something for 10 years that I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
I said, at the end of the day, I love racing. I fell in love with it, and I wanted to pursue this just as much as you, if not more. I was doing it for me. You got me into it, but I wasn't doing this all for you. So yeah, I took a bit of, I guess, ownership over the fact that I loved racing, like, as much as he loved me doing it, I loved it myself
and
as well,
and clearly still do. Did it not awaken any element of fear?
Don't get me wrong, there was definitely a moment after my accident, when I first got back in a race car, I think it was about 11 weeks after my accident, I got my race license back, and I went to Brands Hatch, and since the age of, like I say, 6-7 years old, I drove in a conventional way.
Pause there a second. You went back into a car 11 weeks after the accident.
Yeah, I still had.
What are you going to say? Like 2 years?
What is going on?
No, it was about a month and a half after I got home from hospital. Someone offered me the chance to drive, not like a full blown racing car, but go to a Brands Hatch and do like a sort of track day. And it was a VW Fun Cup car.
Is a car modified? Do you have to have a slightly different?
So this car was actually through a charity called Team Brit, and they started up this charity to for when like veterans and people from the military have accidents.
Okay.
It's a way of getting them back into sort of normal life, so they can either learn how to be mechanics and engineers through this team, or they can have a go at driving the cars, and it's all hand controls and completely different. So I remember rocking up on that morning and kind of going, them showing me the steering wheel and going, okay, the throttle's on the steering wheel here, brakes here, gears are there, and I'm sat there going, this means nothing to me. This is all
almost feels like a different sport, doesn't it?
Yeah,
almost.
Literally, like I was starting from scratch again.
Yeah.
So I remember thinking, all right, well, I'm here now, so let's get out there and have a go. And the first sort of 5 to 10 laps, I remember every time I've been in a race car up until, you know, I had the accident, that was like my comfort zone. That's where I was comfortable. You know, if you're a good footballer and you're out on the pitch, that's where you're in your element. You know, you're comfortable with what's going on around you. It was the same for me in a race car. That was where, you know, I thrived. All the worries and stress that I might have from day-to-day life, out the window, just all you got to focus on is just doing your thing and enjoying it. And I remember those first 5-10 laps actually having that fear factor all of a sudden there, whilst driving a race car, which I'd never had before. So it was like, can I do this again? I was generally questioning that the first 10 laps, like, this feels weird, like braking, throttle with here, you know. Once I got my head around the controls a bit and I felt like I wasn't going to press the brake instead of the throttle and like random stuff like that, then I was kind of like, then I started to ease a bit. And then probably about half an hour into the day, I was like, I'm back. It just felt right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Men's Room podcast on TalkSport is proudly sponsored by Toolstation. This is your little reminder that you can join the Toolstation Club today online, in-store or via the app. You might be thinking, why would I sign up? Well, I'm glad you asked. At Toolstation, if you keep spending, you keep on saving. Signing up means that not only will you get a lovely 5% discount shopping with Toolstation, but there are thousands of prizes to be won. So that's the Toolstation Club. So make sure you join today online, in-store or via the app.
What was it like, all the support you got from just... And that's one thing about sort of the British public, isn't it? Like, the British public get behind you, no matter what. When you need help, they do. So not just the support from the general public, but support from Lewis Hamilton as well. What was that like?
I mean, Lewis Hamilton was my hero growing up.
Sir Lewis Hamilton.
But yeah, he was my hero growing up. When I started... So I was born in 99. So when I started karting, it was sort of 2007, around that sort of era. Yeah. And that's when Lewis Hamilton just got thrown into an F1 seat and hit the ground running. So, you know, I'm looking at him going, right, he's British. He's smashing it in Formula One. That's what I want to be like. I want to be like Lewis Hamilton. You know, that's where I want to get to. And all of a sudden I have this accident. And then I've got, you know, people like him, you know, donating money to help support my rehabilitation and reaching out to me and spending personal time with him.
How did Lewis Hamilton end up getting in touch with you? How did it all...
Well, I think the motorsport community is a fairly tight-knit community because, like I say, it's not like... Football's a huge sport. Motorsport, I guess, is more... It's a niche sport. Less people do it.
Through, don't you? F4 to F3
to
F2.
So you always kind of, I guess, have tabs on what's going on in the other sort of motorsport categories and stuff like that. And the fact my accident was broad live cast on TV and then it ended up quite quickly on YouTube and it did the rounds on socials and on the news. I think quite quickly everyone in the motorsport community was aware of this kid's had a crash, he's become a double amputee. So I feel like at first it was just them purely being generous individuals and just looking out for someone. Like they went on the same career trajectory as I did, and they were they obviously related to it.
It's interesting to hear this though, because I think sometimes, unfairly in my opinion, but I think sometimes Lewis Hamilton gets quite a bit of stick.
Yeah,
this is a story. I didn't know that he had a contribution to this.
Yeah,
it's very.
He gave me a lot of time after my accident, not only like from a financial point of view, like this Just Forgiven page was set up to aid my rehabilitation and he donated to that, but it was more than that from people like Lewis. It was, you know, he invited me to go to the British Grand Prix 2 years in a row with him.
Donated his win to you?
Dedicated a win at British Grand Prix to me, and sort of I was there that whole weekend, so he showed me around the car and the steering wheel and spent like, you know, good few hours of his day whilst he's at British Grand Prix with all the pressure on his shoulders trying to win, spending that time with me.
God,
you know, that's like unheard of, really. So
there's a really good piece in the doc, actually, which I love, probably one of my favourite pieces, when you're in the F3 car and you're showing him how it all works and he picks up the steering wheel and he's like, well, the throttle's a bit tight in this bit.
Yeah.
But it felt really good just because it wasn't him looking down at you as, oh, I just want to help you because you're a double amputee. It's more like, this is just a racing driver to a racing driver conversation. Yeah. And that must feel good as well, because that's what you want to be. That's what you are. Do you know what I mean? You have arguably the greatest racing driver just talking about the steering wheel and I'd like this and talking about different tracks. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, that's who I am. I'm a racing driver. Like all this other stuff that's come off the back of my accident, it took me a good few years to wrap my head around people like calling me inspiration and all of this stuff. Mm. It was in my head, I'm like, well, I'm just a teenager who loves racing that's doing racing. Okay, I've had a big accident and my injuries are visible, but like, why are people now all of a sudden, like, you know, saying that I'm all these things? I didn't believe it myself. Mm-hmm. And I still struggle with it.
You're wrong on that front. You're definitely
But I life. Still struggle on it. But anyway, that sort of was in the background. But yeah, that moment in the documentary where I went up and to Silverstone and was able to, at that point, it'd been, I think that was sort of February of 2018. So it'd been about 6-7 months. So over the winter, me and the race team had sort of designed from scratch new control system that I was able to drive a single seater with.
Carlin
were the team that I race for. Mm. So they, my best mate, when I had my accident, who I was racing against in F4, he invited me whilst I was sort of sat at home doing my rehabilitation, and I had a bit of spare time on my hands. He invited me to go up to their factory So I got introduced to everyone, and then eventually I had a go on their simulator, and they just really basically converted like the gear levers for me to be a throttle and brake, put it in automatic mode, which obviously you would never race in, and went just do a few laps. And it was like I wasn't a million miles off the pace. I was only a few seconds a lap off the pace. So they were like, oh, okay, interesting. And it was like, why don't you come back again with Jamie? We'll have a think about, you know, what we can kind of do with the controls and stuff, and you can do some more laps when he comes down next time. I was like, yeah, sure, I'm well up for that. And then quite quickly I was telling them that, yeah, I want to be racing next year, I want to do F3 ideally. And I think it
did
was
your mum ever just, not say no?
I can't imagine your mum,
because obviously the dog doesn't really show that, but I can't imagine her just saying, yeah, you know, go ahead, have a go again.
Did your mum ever say no?
Like I say, my mum was a rock star when it happened, and she took me to all my appointments, took time off of work. She was fortunate to be able to do that, and basically got me from point A of being a WMT, not knowing what things were going to look like, to getting me to a point where even when I started going to Carlin, I was still in a wheelchair, but even when I started racing again in 2018, I was walking on prosthetics quite quickly. It's only taken me a few months, but I had like walking sticks. So again, that for me was difficult to get my head around, because, you know, I've got sticks next to me. I'm like, you know, this is what I expect to see people like when they're like 80 odd, when they've got, you know, the walking stick and stuff, and I'm walking around like that. But she was really good with that side of things, and she quite quickly realised, well, I was talking about racing even when we were in hospital. So as much as she was like, no, you're not doing that,
there was an inevitability to it.
There was inevitability to it, and I think she knew that I at least wanted to try. That's one thing I said to her, is that I don't want to be here in 30 years time, sort of when I'm 40 years old, kind of going, what if I could have raced again? You know, what if that was possible for me? So I think knowing that, you know, there was potentially going to be a lot of regrets on the table if I didn't give it a go, I think she was open to, she knew that that would probably be worse off for me in the long term, living with those regrets, than just the sort of having to put her own emotions to the side and kind of be like, right, let's just let Billy have a go.
How's that all going now? How's the racing
going? Racing going? To be honest, at the minute, I've not been doing that much racing.
Too basically famous now.
Too famous.
It's unfortunately for me, again, it's a... I wish that was the case, but it actually, annoyingly, it was a COVID thing for me. But my accident happened in 2017. So 2018, I went back to racing, and 2019, I stepped up and did F3 in Europe. And then 2020 was my plan, was to do the official F3 championship, and then F2, F1, you know, and I had the sponsorship sort of all kind of lined up for that. And then COVID hit, everything kind of gets put on a back burner. All the sort of series below F1 kind of were like not really happening, and I lost a lot of sponsorship fundamentally. So all the, you know, because it's a silly expensive sport, but you know, I always said that before my accident, the level I was at, F4, that was the level that, between having like family sponsors and stuff like that, that was the level that as a family we could financially reach. So the 2 years that I did F3 were years where realistically, if I hadn't had my crash, I don't know whether I'd been able to afford to be out on the grid. And then, like I say, COVID came about, that sort of effectively, I lost just over half of my sponsorship just from companies not having the money to throw into stuff like that. So it's a shame, but you know, a lot of people were in the same boat with me, that, you know, a lot of drivers lost their sponsors, lost their gigs, and haven't been able to bounce back. So luckily I'm in a fortunate position where I've been able to move into other things and do the TV side of Formula One and still keep myself involved in the sport I'm so passionate about. But I still got that itch to be behind the wheel, but we're working on it.
Talk to me about, from time of accident to jumping back into the F3 car, so what was that, 11 months?
Yeah.
Getting on the podium, which is ridiculous, and then winning a race as well. Like, how you've done that full circle, and from the accident to winning a race, how long? What's the gap?
From an accident to winning a race, I think was, I want to say maybe like 18 months or something like that.
Amazing. Astonishing.
Yeah.
Astonishing. Not just winning a race, but you the accident was in F4.
Yeah.
Then you've gone up to a faster car in F3.
Yeah.
You know, bends are tighter. Everything's a bit more crazier, isn't it? And then you're winning a race in F3.
Yeah.
It's Honestly, it's miraculous.
The approach I had to it was, after my accident, when I kind of, everything had kind of settled down and I was speaking into the governing body of the sport about, you know, being able to race again, because at that time there was a rule in place saying that disabled drivers couldn't compete in single seaters, which, to be fair, from working with the governing body, they didn't really know why that rule was in place.
Yeah.
So it was quite an easier process to overturn. But when I had meetings with all these big bosses of motorsport,
they looked very posh and very tough as well.
I felt a little bit out of my depth. Rocking up to an event in Paris with all these big bosses in a room, like sat around a table like this, having to fight my case for why I should be able to race again. But I told them that I wanted to do F3, and they were all like, oh, well, maybe you should, you know, go back into F4. That's what you were racing when you had your accident. Maybe that's, you know, that would be the smart move. Well, I was like, the way I approached it was like, I don't want my accident to affect my career. And if I didn't have my accident, my plan next year or this year would be to be an F3. So that's what I want to do. And they were like, okay. Yeah. And I managed to convince them that I was capable of doing it.
How have you handled this new, I think fame's the wrong word because it's come off something so bad, but throughout, considering how negative that was, how positive your life has become from that, it's a good thing. How have you handled that? People recognising you and everything.
Do you know what? Like I said, that was probably one of the trickiest parts about the whole situation for me, like being an 18-year-old and just...
Still doing A-levels.
Still doing my exams and all that malarkey, which I wasn't very good at school, but, you know, we'll skip over that bit.
I realised the doc skipped over that as well. And next week...
He went, cut.
But yeah, I was doing normal stuff as well and going back to racing, which for me was normal. And all of a sudden, like you say, all these motorsport fans and people were pulling me up in the street saying, oh, you're an inspiration, this, that and the other. And I'm kind of there like, thanks, but didn't know really how to handle it or like how to take it. So yeah, it was really weird. At first I kind of wanted to push it all away because when I was actually driving, that was like my peaceful moment. You know, when obviously there was all the sort of, you know, noise around me getting back into a car, got back into a car, my first race, got a podium, then there was obviously more noise surrounding it and stuff like that. And it, don't get me wrong, it was all positive, you know, I've had very few negative comments around it. So I was super lucky in that aspect. You know, because a lot of the time when there's noise on social media and all this stuff, it's more negative than positive, you know what I mean?
You've never had a positive comment on social media.
But yeah, so I can't knock people for being negative towards me because that wasn't the case. But even with all this positivity, it was still, I found it quite difficult still to deal with that kind of like, was like in my head, like I said, nothing's changed here. I'm still a racing driver, but all of a sudden people label me as inspiration. I felt pressure to live up to it all of a sudden. Like all these people were telling me how, you know, how amazing I am as a person and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, how do I live up to that? What do I have to change? I felt like I had to change something about myself.
People are acknowledging just who you are, aren't they? They're not asking you to do anything. Like,
no.
It's simply who you are.
But I think that's how I was thinking about it. I was thinking like, oh well, like I didn't think I was an inspiration before, so maybe I need to do stuff slightly differently to live up to that.
Yeah, you can't come at the nightclub now, can you? Can't fall out of the nightclub, can you? Do you know what I mean?
What's life like on that, you know, on that front?
Yeah.
So you now have two prosthetic legs.
Yep.
How do you find mobility? How do you find sort of ducking and diving through London on the tube?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable? Are you confident?
I'm used to it now. Obviously, like I say, it's been sort of 6 years since my accident, so I've kind of, you know, developed all the muscle groups and sort of trained and got myself into a physical position where I can handle all of those things. Don't get me wrong, like stairs are my kryptonite.
It's handy that we put this studio upstairs in the pub.
I was thinking, come on boys, come on, stitch me up. They're my kryptonite because there's basically, I've been doing stairs the same way since my accident. There's no like way to make stairs look super like I wasn't empty. When I'm walking down the street with jeans on, you might think I've got like a little bit, I walk a little bit funny, but you couldn't tell at the same time. Well, when I'm on steps, I'm like, I also have to put my hand up behind people like, this is going to be a bit slow. Sorry if you're in a rush sort of thing when you're on the train.
Do you find people generally quite understanding and respectful?
Really, really so. it's weird. When I first had, again, when I first had my accident, the first couple of years afterwards, I would always, just from a ease of more than anything, I would always wear shorts. So like people highlights that you couldn't see that. Well, like nowadays I'm more, you know, like I've, you know, figured out ways of, you know, making jeans work for me, and I just wear normal conventional clothing. So sometimes people, you know, you're walking a bit funny, but people can't see any reason why. So I guess there's maybe sometimes a little bit of that in like a bar or something, like knock into you and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's changed slightly in that aspect, but no, people are always
fine. And are you still living at home?
Yeah, still at home with mum, dad, sister at the minute. Yeah, kind of getting to the stage where looking for my own spot, but
you do a lot for charity as well, don't you? I can't swim, so the triathlons that you do, I'd have to pass on that. I could potentially do the cycling, maybe about 5k the jogging. Can't swim.
That's fundamental, mate. Come on.
Can't swim. What are you talking about? Like, I know this isn't the place for these podcasts,
How far did you swim?
The furthest I've ever swum in one hit is 3.8 kilometres. So it took me about an hour and a half.
Would you just drown?
Obviously, yeah.
No, you literally just go, you sink. I'll just sink.
I think I could give it a go for 100 metres. Yeah. Just really give it a go.
You ain't going to hang off the back of me when we're in the water. Take us both down.
He would watch me drown, this kid. He would
you're on your own in that front. You should learn to swim, surely.
Different podcast.
So when you swim, do you swim in like it's all upper body?
Pretty much, yeah. It's pretty much upper body. So when I swim at the minute, when I swim breaststroke. Yeah. You basically use the muscles, the big muscles I've still got my upper body. I don't really do, it looks a bit different as such. I don't really do a typical front crawl, but I can do it. And do you know what's a lot easier as well is, I found this straight away, because swimming is like low impact. So it was one of the first cardio things I started doing after becoming a WMT when I couldn't get up and walk and do any running or anything like that. You go in the pool. I always used to, when I was a kid, my legs would always, you know, I'd always go, they'd always sink.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be able to float on my back, mate. I could float on my back in a pool for days, honestly. Yeah, if shit goes down and I'm on it, I'm floating there for a good couple of days.
If you're using you as a life raft.
Yeah. Probably would. Do you still harbour ambitions of doing F1? Is that still something in the back of your mind, like, you know what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still... You know, that's still, like, the childhood dream's never going to change. Like, that is my childhood dream, Formula One world champion. And it makes it harder in a lot of ways doing the stuff I do now, where I'm on the other side of the camera.
You're seeing it, yeah.
And I'm watching all these boys, you know, new kids come into the sport. And I'm like, I'm still thinking of ways of how can I get back in the seat? How can I raise some money? How can I go out there and show what I'm capable of? Because I still have that underlying sort of ambition that I need to be on that grid. Like, that is where I'm meant to be. Especially if I've raced probably about 5 or 6 of the boys in F1 in karting. I was teammates with George Russell in karting when we were 12 years old. So now he's out there with a Mercedes smashing it week in, week out. And I'm like, mate, I've beaten you in a go-kart before, that could have been me. Like, but again, I try not to, you know, I just take
the positive.
Take things for what they come. If that opportunity comes up, I'll be ready to take it out with both hands. But equally, I've got a lot of other stuff going on as well. So
let's talk about the other stuff. Obviously, you've got a podcast with Johnny Herbert.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how you get a word in, if I'm honest with you. I mean, I've had him on Talk Sport, talking F1. It's like, just line it up, Johnny, and here he goes for 4 minutes. What's that like, though? You must enjoy that, though.
Yeah, it's interesting for me. Johnny, my relationship with Johnny started after my accident, because I didn't know him before. Obviously, I knew him as being an F1 driver. Yeah. He was one of the first people to come and see me in the hospital in person, because he had a big accident himself in racing. So it would be like a Premier League footballer coming to see one of you boys if you had something go on. Like, that's crazy. What it felt like
when
to me.
Like that,
do you know what I mean? That's what it felt like. I was in hospital, and next thing you know, Johnny Herbert's at the end of my bed. I'm like, all right, this is a bit surreal, but we'll go with it. I'm seeing things here, but something's going on. But he rocked up, kind of went through what he went through, like, spoke to my mum, dad, sister, you know, and we stayed in touch ever since. So I've seen him around the paddock at F1 races, because he did his bits with Sky, I was working with Channel 4, so we'd see each other in and around the paddock. So that's where our relationship came from. So I've got a lot of time for Johnny, because, you know, coming down to see someone in hospital not everyone did that, and not everyone would have needed to do that, but he felt the need to come and see me. So I got a lot of respect for him.
How did the podcast come about then?
So the podcast came about, I was thinking of doing something more. I wanted to do more in the F1 space. Like, my work with Channel 4 I really enjoy, but you know, I wanted to, I found myself coming back from race weekends on a Monday night, being sat in the pub with my mates, so I play five-side football, so we'd always sort of sit around there, and it would be almost like an F1, it would turn into like an F1 debrief after weekend. Bill, you've been away this weekend in Italy, like, what happened with Lewis, why did this happen? And I'm getting like thrown all these questions from my mates, like mainly since Drive to Survive, because before Drive to Survive, when I raced they didn't care at that point. They were like, oh, how'd you get on? Oh, I finished first, second, third. Oh great, that would be it. And then Drive to Survive came out, and all of a sudden they're all huge F1 fans now, which I always find a bit surreal. But yeah, they would pepper me with all these questions. So I thought, there's a lot of people out there that are new to sport, don't know a lot about it, that want to find out more about it. Like, there's interest there. So I thought, maybe there's something that I can be doing in that space to just try and help people understand it a bit more and to give my perspective. And then Johnny, there was a news where him and Sky sort of parted ways. So I thought, I'll get on with Johnny. He's a really good guy. He's from a completely different era that I'm from, so he's raced against Schumachers, Sennas, you know. I'm more up to date with the modern guys in Formula 1.
They say that's the era, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
That's the era. Well,
it's the big names of the sport, isn't it? Yeah. You know, so I'm just thought, why not, you know, use the people that he's raced against, the experience he's got, and what I've got of, you know, the modern people in Formula 1, put the both together, and let's just have a chat like you would in the pub about F1 after the weekends, and try and answer some people's questions that might not know that much about the sport.
Well done, honestly. Do you travel to all the circuits with F1?
Not all of them. So I do.
Was you in Miami?
No, I wasn't. I was in Miami last year. Wasn't there this year. I do about just over half of the races. They switch presenter lineup for race to race, but yeah, I do just over half of them.
It's not bad, is it? Brilliant. I mean, that would be like, to do the circuit with F1 would be like a box ticked. Because it's just some of the greatest places on the planet.
A lot of travel, though. Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
It's always a very glamorous. It seems to always be good destinations.
It does, doesn't it?
It seems to always be very glamorous. Yeah, you're going to Monaco or Singapore.
Growing up, it was only Monaco that was glamorous.
Monaco was
glamorous. But now, all of a sudden, they're all glamorous, aren't they?
But you boys know what it's like working in the stuff you work in.
I'm a Chelsea fan. I've seen Chelsea play in Sunderland. I've seen Chelsea, you know, I've had to change at Darlington Station for far too many times. Like, trust me, it's not all glitz and glam.
It's
not Monaco.
Yeah, but Monaco's, the glitz and glam, but there's obviously parts to it where, you know, you're still sleeping, you're not in your bed at night, you're in some hotel room in the middle of 20 minutes from the circuit, you know, all that. So there's that side of things to it. But yeah, I love what I do. Being the age I'm at and getting to just be, you know, paid to travel around with a Formula One and go to all these cool countries and cool places, you know, I'm getting to, in a lot of ways, travel around the world for free at a young age. Like, there's a lot that can be said about that.
Dude, before we wrap, what's the name of the podcast again?
Lift the Lid.
Well done, honestly, well done. We could talk for hours.
Yeah, we say it too often. Like, quite often when we invite people on, you know, the word legend is bandied around, isn't it? Inspiration is bandied
That's
around.
That's us.
Yeah, that
means a lot coming from a Chelsea fan.
But we do, you know, we talk maybe even some of our icons in football, you know, we use very generous and superlative words to describe them, and it's not always accurate, but in this case it is genuinely accurate. We have a legend and an inspiration on the show. Thank you so much for coming on, Billy. Really been great.
Cheers to
you,
boys.
Thank you so
Billy,
much.
I really hope that in a few years' time we're looking back and you have got into the F1 car. Have you done any testing?
I've done one day in an F1 car. Wait, back in a 2009.
Enjoy the commentary. Have a lovely, lovely time from the commentary box. It's the way I feel about Frank Lampard. Stay clear of management. Enjoy being in the commentary box.
But the thing is, Frank Lampard's gone to management and failed. We need to see him get in the F1 car and give
it
a go.
You haven't seen me fail yet.
Multiple times. But yeah, sorry, go on. So you've done testing?
Yeah, I've done a test in a Formula One car back in it was a 2012 Formula One car.
Yeah.
Yeah, rocking them. So really enjoyed that. Want more of it though.
What's it like, the feeling in it? Because I remember, again, sorry, I know I'm going to keep rattling on that, but I remember how different you said the F4 to the F3 car was.
Yeah, it's a step
up. That different from F3 to F1. How different is it?
It's just purely horsepower and downforce. And yeah, your neck wants to fall off in a Formula One car.
Jesus, that? Like
the G-forces are the thing that you know, if I chucked one of my mates in the car, that would be the thing that would, you know, grab your attention the most. And the brakes, you know, you're in a road car, you look up ahead of you, you know how long you've got on the brakes to slow up there. That's
that
like
G-force
a quarter
thing,
of a distance.
I've never understood it. Have you seen Top Gun too? Please tell me you
love
Tom
Top
Cruise.
Gun.
How
love
good
Top
is
Gun.
That?
Made me want to get in a plane. I think I'm just wired a bit differently.
Yeah. And it keeps on talking about that G-force. Mm. And I've never understood what it meant. Explain it to me very quickly. Like,
so one G is basically your body weight being pushed against the side of your head. So you've got to resist, say you weigh...
Your body weight?
Yeah, your body weight. So
against the side of your head?
Yeah, so it's like the equivalent of you weigh 60 kilos, 1G is like 60 kilos of force being pushed in your head that way. And an F1 car, you've got like 5G. Oh, so your neck is like 300 kilos
or
equivalent. You have to do
the Mike Tyson network.
Yeah. Generally, yeah. That's
crazy because you guys must be so strong because most Formula 1 guys are small.
No, they're strong, man.
They must be...
No, they're
yeah.
rich.
Compact,
yeah. Compact, yeah.
Rich.
Your core workouts must be incredible.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. Billy?
He's wicked at a plank.
Who?
Wicked at a plank.
All Formula One drivers. plank for days.
Yeah. I do planks. I'm quite strong at planks as well.
There you go. Formula One driver it's in the making.
Let's wrap because you're about to say something stupid. It's coming. I can see in your eyes you're about to say something stupid. Billy, honestly, fantastic to have you there, mate.
Cheers, boys.
Honestly, as Rory said, inspirational. Yep. I know you hate hearing that, but it's true. Unfortunately, it is what it is, Bill.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Look, we always try and give you the best episodes, and this one, probably our best yet. We said that last week, so every week, we said Tom Skinner was the best.
Who's on next? Who's out doing me next week?
It's just us now. It's just us now. It's just us. It's just us.
We're going to find out why
the figures
swim.
Go down. But look, as always, thank you for tuning into the Men's Room podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you like, share, leave a comment. Me and Roy will jump into the comments as well and respond back to you. And make sure you share this on every single platform you can share it because a lot of people need to hear this story. Rory Jennings, Billy Monger, thank you very much for tuning into this one.
ToolStation are the proud sponsors of the Men's Room podcast on TalkSport. Join the ToolStation Club today online, in-store or via the app, and you will save some money getting a 5% discount shopping with ToolStation, as well as a chance to get your hands on some fantastic prizes, such as TVs, gaming consoles, and even holidays. If all that isn't enough, then remember, if you sign up, then you will get loads of exclusive discounts that aren't available anywhere else. That's the ToolStation Club, so make sure you join today, online, in-store or via the app.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.